The name of the program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This series is called Favorite Poets. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is W.S. Merwin, who won the Pulitzer Prize for The Carrier of Ladders. He is a special consultant to the Library of Congress and to the Poet Laureate of the United States. As we reach this millennium, Mr. Merwin is here to help with his advice. I have some 10 books on the table from which he will read, and we will hear an opening poem from Travels.
There's a poem called The Blind Seer of Ambon. And the blind seer was a man named Georg Edward Rumpf, who was a German who went to the Dutch East Indies, was kidnapped actually and taken out there, and spent the rest of his life there. He was a contemporary of Ben Jonson and Shakespeare. He wrote the first encyclopedia of the Indies and the first flora of the Indies, and lost his wife and his daughter, and finally, on both books and the sight of his eyes, rewrote both books. He wrote them first in Latin and then in second time in Dutch and illustrated them. And they've survived. They're extraordinary books. And he became blind in the end of his life. And the island he lived on was Ambon. So the title of the poem is The Blind Seer of Ambon. I always knew that I came from another language. And now when I can no longer see, I continue to arrive at words. But the leaves and the shells were already here, and my fingers finding them echo the untold light and depth. I was betrayed into my true calling and denied in my advancement. I may have seemed somewhat strange, caring in my own time for living things with no value that we know. Languages wash over them one wave at a time. When the houses fell in the earthquake, I lost my wife and my daughter. It all roared and stood still, falling where they were in the daylight. I named for my wife a flower as though I could name a flower. My wife dark and luminous and not there. I lost the drawings of the flowers in fire. I lost the studies of the flowers, my first 6 books in the sea. Then I saw that the flowers themselves were gone. They were indeed gone. I saw that my wife was gone. Then I saw that my daughter was gone. Afterward, my eyes themselves were gone. One day I was looking at infinite small creatures on the bright sand. And the next day is this hearing after music. So this is the way I see now. I take a shell in my hand, new to itself and to me. I feel the thinness, the warmth, and the cold. I listen to the water, which is the story welling up. I remember the colors and their lives. Everything takes me by surprise. It is all awake in the darkness.
The voice of W.S. Merwin. Mr. Merwin has been at the library as a visitor before. He is the author of the collections The Carrier of Ladders, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize, The Compass Flower, The Rain in the Trees, The Vixen, Flower and Hand, The River Sound. His translations include selected translations, for which he won the Penn Translation Prize. His selected poems have won an award. His vertical poetry is a collection of poems by Juarez. I'd be up very late tonight if I read the title of all of your translations, all of your plays, and all of your books. But we will be able to mention many of them today. Will we be hearing another poem from Travels? I do know this book. I understand that there are different persona throughout the book. You gave us a sample of one.
Yes. There are many of them that are about other lives and other travels. The last ones are short poems that are about travels of my own. And this is one of them, called On the Old Way. After 12 years and a death, returning in August to see the end of summer, French skies and stacked roofs, the same grays, silent train sliding south through the veiled morning, once more the stuccoed walls, the sore pavilions of the suburbs, glimpses of rivers known from other summers, leaves still green, with chestnuts forming for their only fall out of old dark branches, and again the nude hills come back, and the sleepless night travels along through the day as it once did over and over, for this was the way, almost home, almost certain that it was there, almost believing that it could be everything in spite of everything.
That is a very celebrated poem and much admired. Is that the first time it was published, that
yes.
poem?
I think it was in the New Yorker before that.
That's
yes.
right. I have here a stack of books which would scare any other man away, but you're undaunted. And the top one I've chosen is called Flower in Hand because it's a new book, and it takes into account three previous books. Flower in Hand has poetry from The Compass Flower, that was 77, Feathers from the Hill, 81, and Opening the Hand, 83. I like very much the combination of titles then, Flower and Hand. Did you have something to do with that?
Well, we put together The Compass Flower and Opening the Hand.
And this is Copper Canyon Press, who should get all kind of kudos.
Oh, they're wonderful.
Oh, they're terrific, aren't they? I have chosen two poems just to give you a taste of this. And the first one is The Heart. You have to be a pretty good sport to be handed a book without warning.
The Heart is, the introductory poem to The Compass Flower. And because it's a compass, it has four directions and four parts, and so does the heart. In the first chamber of the heart, all the gloves are hanging but two. The hands are bare as they come through the door. The bell rope is moving without them. They move forward cupped as though holding water. There is a bird bathing in their palms. In this chamber there is no color. In the second chamber of the heart, all the blindfolds are hanging but one. The eyes are open as they come in. They see the bell rope moving without hands. They see the bathing bird being carried forward through the colored chamber. In the third chamber of the heart, all the sounds are hanging but one. The ears hear nothing as they come through the door. The bell rope is moving like a breath without hands. A bird is being carried forward, bathing, in total silence. In the last chamber of the heart, all the words are hanging, but one. The blood is naked as it steps through the door, with its eyes open and a bathing bird in its hands, and with its bare feet on the sill, moving as though on water, to the one stroke of the bell. Someone is ringing without hands.
Mm. We are at the Library of Congress with W.S. Merwin. I have chosen Twilight also.
Oh, you are never tame, fire on a mountain, eyes beside water, first day of petals, lying across the bed in afternoon rain light, arms of evening, wherever we are as ashore.
W.S. Merwin has been awarded the Tanning Prize, the Pulitzer, and Bollingen Prizes, the Fellowship of the Academy of American Poets, the Shelley Memorial Award, the Penn Translation Prize, and many other honors. Is there a prize you haven't gotten?
Oh, I'm sure.
Oh, well, let's get it.
Don't think about that.
Oh, you can. W.S. Merwin, I chose these poems because he is our most celebrated poet in America, with his life a testimony to the spiritual identity of the poet. And he is famous. If one can be famous for confronting their mortality, you have over your life's work chosen to be a voice before you were born, while you're here, and speak as if you have already gone. It is an eternal voice, and I think that you will be known for that. Much will be written about that. we're very honored to have him, and we're plowing through, actually. We have the three books which were compiled into Flower in Hand, so I thought it might be nice to have a taste of each. And I love The Dreamers. Do you like that?
We're going backwards, aren't we? Yes, sure.
We are, I mean, in time.
I don't have opinions about my poems, I mean, mostly, but there they are. Once I've let them go, as the cat lets their kittens go, you know what I mean? They don't belong to me anymore. Yeah, why not start with the first one, which was the breakthrough poem, when all of the new poems began.
What is the title?
Home for Thanksgiving.
Oh.
I was thinking of an old sourdough that I saw on the streets of Montreal when I was 19 years old, and that's what I was thinking about. And so it's in his voice.
Now, I looked at that, and I said, he's not going to want to read that.
Well, some people have thought it was autobiographical, but it certainly is not. No, there are things in the poem that I would never say myself, about myself. But it's has a kind of relation to the poems and travels in that it's in the voice of somebody talking about their lives. And this was long before travels. This was when I was 30 that I wrote this poem, called Home for Thanksgiving. I bring myself back from the streets that open like long, silent laughs, and the others spilled into in the way of rivers breaking up, littered with words, crossed by cats and that sort of thing. From the knowing wires and the aimed windows. Well, this is nice, on the third floor and back of the billboard, which says, now improved, and I know what they mean. I thread my way in, and I sew myself in like money. Well, this is nice, with my shoes moored by the bed, and the lights around the billboard ticking on and off like a beacon. I have brought myself back like many another crusty, unbarbered vessel launched with a bottle from the bare regions of pure hope, where for a great part of the year it scarcely sets at all, and from the night skies regularly filled with the old movies of my fingers, weightless as shadows groping in the sluices, and from the visions of veins like arteries, and from the months of plying between can and can, vacant as a pint in the morning, while my sex grew into the only tree, a joyless evergreen, and the winds played hell with it at night, coming as they did over at least 1,000 miles of emptiness, thumping as though there were nothing but doors, insisting, come out, and of course I would have frozen. Sunday, a fine day, with my ears wiped and my collar buttoned, I went for a jaunt all the way out and back on a streetcar, and under my hat with the dent settled in the right place, I was thinking maybe, a thought which I have noticed many times like a bold rat, I should have stayed making some of those good women happy for a while at least, Vera with the eau de cologne and the small fat dog named Joy, Gladys with her earrings cooking and watery arms, the one with the limp and the fancy sheets. Some of them are still there, I suppose. Oh, no. I bring myself back, avoiding in silence, like a ship in a bottle. I bring my bottle. Or there was thin pearl with the invisible hairnets. The wind would not have been right for them. They would have had their times, rugs, troubles. They would have wanted curtains, cleanings, answers. They would have produced families, their own and our own. Hen friends and other considerations. My fingers sifting the dark would have turned up other poverties. I bring myself back like a mother cat transferring her only kitten, telling myself secrets through my mustache. They would have wanted to drink ship, sea, and all, or to break the bottle. Well, this is nice. Oh, misery, misery, misery. You fit me from head to foot like a good grade suit of longies, which I have worn for years and never want to take off. I did the right thing, after all.
The voice of W.S. Merwin. I am very glad you decided to read that poem, because one of the things you are well known for is taking the dailiness of life, the ordinary moments in life. And your book, Unframed Originals, is a very favorite of mine. I was thinking of that with the characters you evoke here. Those characters will never die. Those characters that you brought forth from your childhood, that prose work, it taught me how to write prose. It is the most unmanipulative, the most genuine. I was astonished with that work. Although your prose is very much praised, Unframed Originals is, I think, much under-recognized.
Well, I'm happy to hear that. What I was doing was, of course, thinking about this strange childhood and this strange family and trying to get it onto paper so that I would remember it, so that I wouldn't lose it.
I'll never forget that limping uncle. I'll never forget the aunts. They're with me forever. I guess you can't say a better thing than that.
No, that's wonderful. Yes, it's what one would hope to do. But
why not read his awards? Why not? Kenyon Review Fellowship, Rockefeller Fellowship, National Institute of Arts and Letters Grant, Arts Council of Great Britain Playwriting, Rabinowitz Foundation, Bess Hocken Prize, Poetry Magazine, Ford Foundation, Chapel Brook Foundation, Harriet Monroe Memorial Prize in Poetry Magazine, Penn Translation Prize, the Pulitzer Prize, the Rockefeller Foundation Grant, Fellowship of the Academy of American Poets, the Guggenheim, the Shelley Memorial Award, Bullingen Prize for Poetry, Yale University Library, Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize, Tanning Prize, Academy of American Poets for Outstanding and Proven Mastery in Poetry. That's 1994. I just think, you know, we never take time to read them all because they take 5 minutes, you know, just the most recent ones. And I bet you couldn't even remember half of them.
Do you think people listen to the whole list?
They were probably walking through the kitchen as
I
read
so.
This. We're moving on.
I think
on.
I've been very lucky. And,
I think you've worked very hard. And a case in point is that there are several books that I hadn't even noted. The Folding Cliffs, I do not know. And recent collections are Travels and River Sound. That was just 1999. The Vixen was mentioned. And there is yet one more.
Oh, it's the translation of Dante's Purgatorio, which is coming out in next April.
For which we will give an entire hour. At this point, we will move on. Let's see, did we hit upon this one, The Vineyard?
Oh.
I wanted this because we both knew Bill Matthews.
Yes. And this poem was dedicated to Bill.
It was early on. You must have been old friends.
We were old friends.
And he was a lovely, lovely man, wasn't
wonderful
he?
Wonderful man.
And
he didn't get the recognition he deserved. He was beginning to get it just in the last years of his life. But Bill was one of the really most gifted poets of his generation, and there was nobody like him. He was completely his own man, his own poet. He was a very gentle and very witty man with many, many gifts. And he was a great cook, and he loved music, and he was a wonderful friend. I mean, every one of his friends would tell you that.
I've never heard anything bad about him.
He knew an enormous amount about jazz. He was a great. He knew a great deal about all kinds of music. You never knew when you went to see Bill whether he'd have one of his jazz favorites or Haydn Quartet playing in the apartment. He was a wonderful, wonderful cook. And
he said, "Love is our work."
Yes.
That's Bill Matthews. Yes. And here's a poem dedicated to him, I think in 77.
Well, he loved wine. The poem is called The Vineyard. Going up through the hill called The Vineyard that seems nothing but stone, you come to a tangle of wild plum and hazel bushes, the spring in the cliff like the sex of a green woman, the taste of the water and of the stone. You come to the fox's cave in the yellow clay under the foot of the stone, and barely out of reach lime-crusted nests of swallows, and in the cliff higher up holes of swifts and bees, solitary grass. All that stone faces southward and a little to the east, full of crevices, bats and small birds, foxes and wild honey. Clear to the top they call it the vineyard, where earliest the light is seen that bids the cock crow.
The voice of W.S. Merwin, I am Grace Cavalieri. The program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and this series is called Favorite Poets. We are going back in time, and we've picked up another book. This is Writings to an Unfinished Accompaniment. And what is the poem that I have cited there?
The poem is called The Dreamers.
Do you like it?
Oh, you mustn't ask me whether I like poems of mine.
How long ago since you have read that?
Many years.
That's why I thought it'd be fun. Yeah, it's a lovely poem.
This was written in Europe. In one of the dreams, men tell how they woke. A man who can't read turned pages until he came to one with his own story. It was air. And in the morning, he began learning letters, starting with A is for apple, which seems wrong. He says the first letter seems wrong. A man with his eyes shut swam upward through dark water and came to air. It was the horizon. He felt his way along it, and it opened and let the sun out. So much for the sun. And in the morning he began groping for the horizon like the hands of a clock, day and night. A man, nothing but bones, was singing, and one by one the notes opened and rose in the air and were air. And he was each one. Skin, mouth, ears, feeling, feathers. He keeps counting everything aloud, including himself. Whatever he counts, one is missing. I think I fell asleep on a doorstep. Inside, someone was coming, walking on white heads that were the best words I knew. And they woke at that step for the first time and were true. When I came to myself, it was morning. I was at the foot of the air in summer, and I had this name and my hand on a day of the world.
What a last line. What a last line. That's why I chose that poem. You have given dreaming a good name.
In your poetry. I think dreaming began with a good name.
You've made it respectable in poetry.
Really?
Your poems are one long dream.
I think many poets have done that.
Of course they have. But I think consistently that you take us into another state. You do take us into another dimension. You do make the line from here to there very invisible in your work. And I think that's been said.
Well, I think it's much more visible than it really is. I think that the line is hardly visible in our lives around us. We don't realize that we're walking in a dream most of the time.
As you point out in your work, translations have been an essential part of your career, as well as your contribution to American Letters. And as a young man out of Princeton, I think you made a living translating.
Yes.
And I have counted 20 books that I know of that you've translated. And I see in contemporary authors dozens more, but I do know of 20 by one count. And French, Spanish, Latin, Portuguese. Are you still pretty fluent? Can you still do those?
I can't do Latin anymore. I can read Portuguese more or less, but it's pretty rusty. French and Spanish I'm pretty happy with, and a certain amount of Italian. And that's really about it. Everything else I've relied heavily on other scholars and native speakers, and I've always referred to them if I could.
As it is with this book I'm going to hold up here, if this were television, you would see it is a gorgeous book. It's called The Peacock's Egg, and it is Sanskrit, love poems from ancient India, 500 B.C. to 1,000 B.C., and they're pretty hot, too.
They're very hot poems. But those were done, as the jacket makes clear and the introduction, with Jeff Mason, J. Musayef Mason.
I was scared to say it.
Who has become much better known for other things since then.
What a gorgeous introduction, though.
He was in charge of the Freud archives for a while, and then he became a rather controversial figure. But he was a Sanskrit scholar to begin with.
One thing which I learned I had not known is that in Sanskrit poetry, there was never evidence of childhood dreams ever written about by the poet. And the poet would go back to former lives and make up fantasies about former lives to replace that which we all rely on, which is childhood memory. And I thought that was fascinating. And then I thought that I saw influences of The Peacock's Egg in a later book of yours. I'm sure everything must feed into the same river.
Everything influences everything.
I felt so personally involved to have read this and then to have read something which reverberates, you know. It was just a moment with you that no one else had. I thought I had discovered something. This is the book, I think, Opening the Hand was very influenced by The Peacock's Egg.
I don't know. It may have happened, but if it was, I certainly wasn't aware of it, but it probably did.
So I've chosen from one page to, like, another to give a taste of this Sanskrit poetry. Did you get it then in the ancient language and you flat literal English and you turned it into poetry?
That's right.
Is that it?
Yes. With Jeff checking them and making sure we weren't getting astray. And Jeff provided not only the original, but he provided a literal version and then copious notes about the literal phrase by phrase.
So, and there are great footnotes in there, too.
They are wonderful, yes.
So just a handful would be great.
Some of them are probably too erotic to read on the air.
I chose some that were not raunchy.
Yes.
So the FCC wouldn't get us.
That's right. But these are two little ones. And they're all quite short. Some of them, by the way, were written by monks and nuns, which is even more interesting. When hundreds of prayers at last had brought him back from long travels, and somehow the day had been got through, all his friends, fools, never thinking of the hundreds of longing wishes for him that had led her through the day, went on talking and talking until she jumped up saying, "Something bit me," and shaking the end of her sari, wanting him so much, blew out the lamp. Many of them are anonymous. This is modeled on the Kalidasa, which is a very famous Sanskrit poem. This is written by a blind poet of the 6th century named Kumaradasa. It's from a poem on the life of Rama. In their quarrel, she pretended to be asleep until he, shaking with passion, started to take off her dress. "Thief," she said, laughing, and boldly she bit his lower lip.
A lot of these characters wait for their husbands to go away.
Oh, they do. Yes.
Really, it's a precursor of modern literature.
I know.
The voice of W.S. Merwin, I am Grace Cavalieri.